Are your school days out of sight when you took English, art, and math? What's your favorite Fahrenheit? How sour are the grapes of wrath? Do you need a challenger? Poor disgusting Salinger. Do you love the written word? What happened to the mockingbird? Our show is just beginning, so find a place to sit. These questions will be on the test. It's time for Sophomore Lit.
Welcome back to Sophomore Lit, where we reread your 10th grade reading list. I'm John McCoy, and with me is returning host Matt Skuda.
Hi, thanks for having me back.
Hey, Matt, you've been on a lot to discuss, it seems like, a lot of middle readers. I know you've written a picture book. Are middle readers a favorite of yours?
I kind of like them because they're in and out. Like, I mean, I do like short things. I prefer movies to TV just because I do like the ability that people have to tell a complete story in such a short period of time. And I think I have that same affinity for short stories and short books. That doesn't mean I don't, you know, read much longer books and enjoy much longer books, but...
Well, you've certainly chosen a great book for its compactness. We are doing Lewis Sachar's 1998 Holes this time, and I had forgotten just how much plot there was in this book. It's not a very long book, but it is intricate, like few things are.
No, I agree. And one thing I haven't read this in quite a while, and in revisiting it, it kind of felt like a book that you might expect to be, you know, like the length of the Count of Monte Cristo or even like Les Miserables or something. I mean, a lot happened over, you know, basically four time periods, and three of them are treated, you know, very briefly and kind of used only as context for what's happening in the present. But I could see another version of this story being told where there's an unbelievable amount of detail given to all four timelines.
Did you read this book right after it came out?
I don't think so. I think it would have been early 2000s, maybe even closer to like 2004. I was never assigned this book. My sister was, I think, in late middle school or early high school. I feel like late middle school. And I picked it up the summer after she read it, just off the shelf, and read it just at home on a rainy day, I think.
And how old were you?
I was probably in sixth grade or seventh grade even. But weirdly, this book was read to a neighboring third grade class when I was in third grade. Like, aloud. And that seemed like, I mean, not that it's inappropriate for people in third grade, but it does seem a little bit advanced for people in third grade.
It always amazes me, you know, I don't want to be a boring old person, but it always amazes me how much younger people are than I am. This book came out when I was just finishing up my graduate school work and starting to go off into the world as a graphic designer. And the interesting thing about it was I was alerted to this book by a woman who was in my writing program. Back in the early 90s, I was in a creative writing program. I got a master's in fiction. And she told me that there was this book that everyone was talking about and that I had to go out and read. And at the time, I had one child who was, I think, 4 years old. So I would not be reading this book to my child. And my friend, I think, had a child who was 1 year old. So it was all on the strength of the fact that this book had won the National Book Award that year. Mm-hmm. It was a book that was treated very seriously by literary journals as well as by the children's book establishment.
No, that makes sense. I mean, I think it's a really solid story and might be, we'll talk about it. I like this book a lot. And I know I've done a couple books recently, or at least one that I really didn't like on this show. And I think that, you know, maybe hindered my ability to talk about it. But this is a book I really, really enjoyed. And I think there is kind of a, even though there's a simplicity to this story, there is a depth to it that I think a lot of books for this age group don't necessarily have. And you know, like always, no one gives kids enough credit for being able to understand things. Like I said, like a teacher is reading this to a third grade class that seemed to be enjoying it. And I think it's kind of, this is kind of a book that can be introduced early that can, you know, make kids really search for a broader variety of books as they age through school.
Yeah, it's a book that starts off in a kind of a very surreal and fabular style. It's there's something about it that is like a fairy tale. But as it progresses, it seems to become more realistic, which is an interesting move. Although the book never lets up with crazy coincidence and these parallel themes between hundreds of years of the action of the book that stretch credulity and seem to be bound by some sort of a mystic thread. I just recorded last night the podcast on The Westing Game with my brother Dan, and he said of The Westing Game that it reminded him of Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, in that you didn't really know whether you trusted Sam Westing or trusted Willy Wonka, and how benevolent they actually were, whether they had good intentions or bad intentions for the events that they were orchestrating. That it's a sort of a modern fable, and it has these crazy larger-than-life characters. But unlike Roald Dahl, something switches on halfway through this book where it becomes really, in a very bare way, about some of the nastier aspects of human human behavior, especially when it comes to its examination of race.
No, I thought that was interesting as well. And the way it kind of landed for me is I thought it was, in starting almost as a fairy tale and going into these harder issues of reality, I thought it was kind of telling the audience not to have these idealistic fairy tale memories of the past, or, you know, there's like this kind of fallacy where everyone remembers the past as being a time to hearken back to. And like, this shows kind of even the idyllic town of Green Lake on this lake had a nastiness to it. Or even when you go back to Poland at the beginning.
Oh, sorry, Latvia,
I'm sorry. Thank you.
I have a Latvian connection.
You're kind of dealing with, again, fairy tale elements. And then you're dealing with, you know, how women are treated in that society, and or considered in that society as property rather than people. And it kind of, I think everything kind of had this dichotomy to it that I actually really enjoyed.
I think the other thing that struck me through reading this time was, on the one hand, it's a tough book for kids because it deals with people in extreme peril and people experiencing extreme loss. But on the other hand, it is a book in which the threads of the narrative, one generation's bad luck is the next generation's good luck. And it takes this very long view of history that reminds me of the old Buddhist proverb about not ascribing goodness or badness to anything, because we don't have perfect knowledge of everything. Certainly, you know, Stanley Yelnats, the protagonist, his great-great-grandfather, who allegedly started all the family bad luck, runs into the Kissing Kate Barlow in the Americas and loses his fortune. But he also gains from that encounter a wife, and that leads to the existence of our hero, Stanley Yelnats, was it the fourth?
Yes. So it was the son of the pig stealing grandfather who was robbed by Kate Barlow. Is that right?
Something right. like that. Great 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 grandfather. I thought it was, but
so I thought it was great great grandfather came from Latvia to right. America. His son was robbed, and then that was the second.
That's
and
right.
And then the dad was the third, right. and then Stanley's the fourth.
I don't really want to talk too much about the plot, except as it comes up in our discussion here. This is a story about a young our young protagonist, Stanley Yelnats IV, who seems to be a magnet for bad luck. He's accused of stealing some valuable athletic shoes that were going to be sold at an auction, and he is sent to Camp Green Lake, which we are told, and there are no trees at Camp Green Lake in the opening
lines.
There are
two.
All right. Well, the opening line of the book.
There's no lake at Camp Green Lake.
Oh, right. Right. There's no lake at Camp Green Lake. And it's a good opening line. As I said in my last episode on the Westing Game, which you don't know because you haven't heard it yet, I read an excellent essay called We All Must Play the Westing Game by Nicholas Dames that you can find online. And he sees this opening line as a sort of a stylistic homage to the Westing Game, which opens with the observation that everyone knows the sun sets in the west, but sunset towers face to the east. So in both books, we are presented as readers with a world that lies to you. The place names lie to you, but those lies hold history in them, and they reveal sort of the underlying workings of the world, and you build from there. I think it's an interesting point.
No, it is, and the names in this book, I mean, obviously are, you know, all very pointed, and I think sometimes to its advantage. I think Camp Green Lake is, you know, a very interesting way of doing that. Obviously, it has a history. I've never been a huge fan of the Stanley Yelnats, you know, palindrome situation. I think reading it this time, I had less of a problem with it.
Right. Well, this brings me to my Latvian connection.
Okay.
My wife is Latvian. She's Latvian American. She was born in America, but she was born of, Latvian parents who both come from Riga in Latvia. And I know a little bit about Latvian culture. And while a lot of last names in Latvian do end in S, Yelnats is in no way a Latvian name. It's obviously just made up for the charm of there being a palindrome. There is no Y in Latvian. There's a J that you use in place of Y. It has a Y sound, and it's put in it, like my name John would be Janis. Mm-hmm. But there's no why. So this is a little bit of a fabrication. I forgive Sakar for that, except that Latvia tends to be the go-to country when people want to point to an old world country that nobody knows about. I think it sounds a little bit like Latveria, where Dr. Doom is from.
Yeah,
certainly that's what I thought of when I met my wife, and before I knew anything about Latvia myself, I thought, oh, she comes from the country of Dr. Doom. I didn't even know that it really existed. So anyway,
right? Yeah, I mean, I appreciate the symbolism of the palindrome name, and that
right.
you know, it's like, oh, you know, four generations start with good luck, kind of. Fall into bad luck, rise up back to good luck. And obviously the Zeroni versus Zero was, you know,
right.
But pretty early foreshadowing right. of it, a twist, if you call it a twist, and otherwise just foreshadowing.
Right. So Stanley blames the family's bad luck on this great, great grandfather from Latvia who failed to fulfill an obligation he had made to a gypsy woman. And again, I apologize if that's a little insensitive. I wonder if Sakar would use that today. But the family is allegedly under a curse. and Stanley has been brought as a juvenile to this camp, Green Lake, where everyone is told they have to dig a hole 6 feet deep and 6 feet around every day. And that's a wonderfully surreal thing to start the story with. I mean, eventually we learn there's a reason why the kids are digging a hole. You know, it doesn't take too long to figure out that the nefarious people in charge of Camp Green Lake are searching for something. And it turns out they're searching for the lost treasure of Kissing Kate Barlow. But it starts in this fabulous way, and then it moves into, I think, actually a fairly pointed examination of, on the one hand, the issues of race relations among the kids at the camp, but also the whole idea of incarceration, you know, and what exactly is happening here, and why are these kids, are these kids being rehabilitated? Are they being punished? It turns out that they are being used, and I think today, with a lot of the concern people have over the 13th Amendment and upon the forced use of prison labor, people are starting to re-examine that whole idea in our incarceration system. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of a heavy thing to be putting into a book that's aimed at, I don't know, the fourth or fifth grade.
Right. No, I mean, I was thinking about that. This morning I was thinking about the, you know, Camp Green Lake as a concept and how fantastic it is, or how realistic it is. Like, do you think a thing like Camp Green Lake could actually exist in our world as a place for a juvenile detention camp?
You know, I don't think that it could, or at least I hope that it couldn't.
Yeah, I
agree. And yet we do live in a society where inmates can be forced to work for the state, mm-hmm. on whatever the state decides for them to do, under the auspices of the of rehabilitation, of the idea that somehow work is its own reward, and of course we've had this year here in this country where we've seen all kinds of crazy things having to do with incarceration, the incarceration of minors in this country and of immigrants in this country. I like to believe that this is fiction, mm-hmm. but as I see the world go on, I worry that it is more possible than I had thought it would be. And still, the book has a light touch. It is weird and surreal, and I think that goes a long way to getting you to swallow what is a horrific situation for Stanley, mm-hmm. Without just feeling like this is an oppressive, horrible book you don't want to read.
No, I agree. And something that this book does that I like quite a bit in relation to kind of how the kids are treated is Pendansky specifically, who is, you know, of the three camp people that we see the most in this book. I think the only three that are named were the warden, Mr. Sir, and Mr. Pendansky. Mr. Pendansky is, you know, quote unquote, the nice one.
Yeah.
But by the end, I mean, he says some pretty nasty things about. Throughout, it says some mean things about Zero, but by the end is saying some very nasty things about Zero and Stanley, and about their fate in the desert and right. Zero's intelligence and all kinds of things. And it's kind of, I mean, and I think there's a realness to that honestly, like, really does kind of hit me kind of hard, where you have, you know, this one person you think might just be the tiny bit of hope at this place, and who's in a position of authority, and they're, you know, every bit as bad as the other two.
Yeah. When I think about it, I read a lot of books as a kid that dealt with kids, with children being kidnapped or being imprisoned or in some state of peril. Just as you were talking about this, this reminded me of, I don't know if you ever read the book Jacob Tutu and the Hooded Fang.
No.
By Mordecai Rickler. That was also made into a movie in the mid-70s. But that was also a fantastical story about kids being put off in this prison run by this mad jailer named the Hooded Fang. That was kind of what I was used to as a kid, were these stories where the villains were larger than life, and that made it a little easier. Mm-hmm. In some ways, it's easier to deal with a Captain Hook, you know, who is comical and weird, and you know doesn't actually exist in the world. But someone like Pedansky is, you know, a guy who tries to be on your side, but really is not going to lift a finger to help you in any way, and who is just as invested in the project of exploiting these kids for their labor as the warden and Mr. Sir. You know, that's a little nastier.
I agree, because I was thinking also, like, I thought you were going to either say, like, Matilda or...
oh, yeah, definitely.
Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, which I've not read, but I've only seen the movie, and the Child Snatchers, I think they're called, where you kind of have these... Or even the Goonies, which, like, you have these kind of, you know, bad people who want to harm your children, but you never... The stakes don't feel like they extend beyond the story itself, whereas in Holes, I think they kind of do.
Yeah, no, they and it's weird because early on in the when we are introduced to the warden and Mr. Sir, the warden does a weird villain type thing, which is she paints her fingernails with a fingernail polish made from rattlesnake venom, and scratches Mr. Sir across the face, causing his face to become inflamed. It's just one of those Hollywood moments where the head bad guy turns on one of the underlings just to show how bad they are.
Mm-hmm.
And that reads as sort of comical, as opposed to later on, Stanley and his friend Zero, who's the other main child character in the book, are on the lam running away from Camp Green Lake across the lake bottom, which has completely dried out and is basically desert, and they are close to dying of thirst. You know, actually, I mean, Zero has left. Stanley thinks Zero could be dead already. He's trying to find him, and that's dealt with absolutely seriously and absolutely straight. So there is comic book threat in this book, and then there is like real life threat in this book.
You're right, and I think that's kind of speaks to the why this book might have such a positive legacy, because it again, like we're talking about, it kind of eases you in with things we recognize from fairy tales, whether those are movies or like grim fairy tales or whatever. And drag you down to, you know, real depths. And they even have like Zero's mom, which again, I by the sound of it, you know, is which you would, you know, leave Zero in places and tell him to stay there until she could return. And what I kind of assumed out of that she was, you know, engaged in some sort of prostitution, and that's why she wasn't bringing Zero along. And I thought that was like a very dark element that I had not picked up on previously.
Right. Well, she certainly was involved in something dangerous, whether it was prostitution or something else, that she, you got that feeling that she was in fear of her own safety and couldn't watch out for Zero. And that is a dark shadow that you might not get as a kid reading this book. So at Camp Green Lake, as we've mentioned, the kids are all digging these holes. It turns out they are looking for the treasure of Kissing Kate Barlow. That is something that Stanley is able to piece together after he finds an artifact from Kissing Kate. Because of a little twist in the plot, the camp counselors think that the treasure is buried in one part of the lake. It actually is not the place that, Stanley knows it to be in. And so he has this secret. And then we're treated to these flashbacks about kissing Kate, who up till now has only been the antagonist of Stanley's ancestor. We get to find out her story, although we don't know at first that it's the same kissing Kate. We go back in time into the late 19th century when Camp Green Lake actually has a lake and is green, and there's this lovely little frontier town and a lovely school teacher named Kate who teaches the kids and who falls in love with the local onion seller, Sam, who likes to wander around the place with his donkey selling onions and also espousing their many virtues that they will cause you to live forever, that they will cure all sorts of diseases. They have all kinds of tonic properties. At this point, it's introduced very cleverly as a kind of a joke. I think as a reader, you don't believe Sam's claims. Unfortunately for Kate and Sam, Kate is white and Sam is African-American. And this being the 19th century, there are hanging laws for black men fraternizing with women. And a spurned lover of Kate wants to hang Sam. Sam almost escapes, but he is shot and killed in a very, again, very, very hard section of the book. And Kate becomes Kissing Kate Barlow. She kills the sheriff who arranged the lynching, and she goes on a spree of terror around the region, and the lake dries up, which is probably the most magical thing that happens in this story, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because obviously it's just a short period of time. and then you have the man who called for Sam's death because the lake dried up was was very economically well off, and in the lake drying up loses his wealth, and they ultimately return to Camp Green Lake to find Kate Barlow held up in a cabin, and wherein she's supposedly buried treasure out in the lake, and they threaten her and torture her to figure out where that is, and she commits suicide essentially. And, damns them to have to search for that treasure in a massive lake.
Right. Well, she gets bitten by one of the yellow spotted lizards. I think it is implied that she
lets it happen.
She lets it happen because it's a great out for her. These yellow spotted lizards, by the way, are all over Camp Green Lake, and they are a constant threat in the modern day as well. It turns out, many years later, that the warden is the modern day heir to the property and has hit upon this idea of using the incarcerated child labor to help her search for Kate Barlow's treasure. And so in the present time, Zero, who Stanley learns is actually Hector Zeroni, a great-great-great-grandson of the Madame Zeroni who put the curse on his great-great-grandfather, is his friend and has run off from camp. Zero is illiterate, and Stanley teaches him to read. That becomes another important point in the book. But there's a kind of an unease that's going on here because Zero is black, Stanley is white, and they have reached an agreement that Zero will help Stanley dig his holes in return for reading lessons, which does not sit well amongst the uneasy truce that's going on between the white and black inmates of Camp Green Lake. soccer is good at setting up a situation which is kind of morally cloudy. You know, it does seem like Stanley, on the one hand, is taking advantage of Zero. On the other hand, Zero was the one who offered this. Part of what drives Stanley to go look for Zero is his guilt over feeling like he's made this into a purely transactional relationship, that he feels like he owes more to Zero. And that's part of his redemption story too, is realizing that, you know, sometimes things aren't about necessarily being fair or even, they're about doing what's right.
Yeah. And I'm sorry, kind of going back, because we were talking about, Kate Barlow's property, and I just kind of wanted to talk about, you know, details in the book that imply other things that either get revealed or don't reveal in greater detail. But when Stanley is first led to the warden's cabin, when Mr. Sir is attempting to have him punished for allegedly stealing his sunflower seeds, we are given the description of the holes that are around the cabin in which the warden lives. And these holes are not the, you know, 5 feet wide, 5 feet deep holes that the campers / prisoners are assigned to dig, but are of all different shapes and depths. And I think it's kind of the first time where you're given a history to this cabin and the, you know, legacy of Camp Green Lake. And like what, you know, not that they're searching for something, but that things, what might have set that up. And I like that it's just kind of offhandedly described and then kind of left alone for quite a while until we get the flashback of young, the warden as a young child being forced to dig on the same land she eventually forces.
When Stanley is looking for Zero, he finds Zero in the capsized boat that Sam was shot in, now on the dry lake bed. And it is the preserved peaches that were made for him by Kate that are keeping Zero alive. Fantastically, over the course of 100 years, they're still edible, although they obviously cause a lot of intestinal distress to Zero, but they at least get moisture into him, and they are delicious. And they go ahead.
And the intestinal distress is what forces Stanley to have to carry Zero, thus fulfilling the prophecy and breaking the curse.
Right.
So it kind of, every little thing ultimately does set up. Like, again, it's, everything is kind of a palindrome.
Right. And everything is good and bad. I mean, obviously, it's terrible that Sam was shot. But it is these peaches that save Zero's life. It's terrible that Stanley's great grandfather had his possessions stolen from him. But it's these possessions being recovered that allow Stanley to thrive in the next generation. And it's the fact that Stanley's grandfather's name was written on the case that lets Stanley walk out of there instead of with the case, rather than it being confiscated by the warden. This is at the end of the book when Stanley is rescued by a public defender who comes up. We're never quite explained how his name got cleared, but it did get cleared. And it's at this point that Stanley also refuses to leave without Zero. And so they go together.
And Zero's records have conveniently been destroyed.
Right.
Because they assumed him to be dead and wanted to protect themselves from the state. And then obviously the state, you know,
right,
notices the records are gone. And then that is Zero's. I mean, the camp's apathy was ultimately Zero's redemption.
Right. But it also reflects, in a very pointed way, soccer's criticisms of the justice system, because there is an inequity in the way that the white inmates are being treated over the black inmates. There's an assumption that somebody is somebody cares about Stanley and they are careful with Stanley in a way that they aren't careful with Zero. They assume that Zero has nobody and that nobody cares, so they can do whatever they want with Zero.
Mm-hmm.
So once free, the discovery of the preserved peaches leads Stanley's father to create a foot deodorant that makes the family very, very wealthy, in addition to all the stocks and bonds that were in the grandfather's case. And we have a happy ending. We also have this lovely connection between Stanley and Zero. Stanley was brought up being sung a family lullaby that I think anyone who's read this book remembers this lullaby very well. And at the very end, when Zero's mom is able to come back and be with Zero, she sings the lullaby. And the other thing that's beautiful about this lullaby is every time it's given in the book, it's slightly different.
Mm-hmm.
It shows that, you know, soccer is very smart about this. This is an oral tradition, and every branch of that tradition has its own quirks and variations.
Right. So I guess the evolution of that would have been, it started as a Latvian song that rhymed in Latvian. The wife of Stanley Yelnats II, reworded it in English to make it rhyme in English. And that's the song we're given throughout. And then at the end is when we're revealed the kind of basically what we assume is more closer to the Latvian one, because it does rhyme, but it rhymes totally differently.
Right.
Because it's reply by boldly only. So you kind of two different groups of people, created a new version of this song that rhymed in English. I thought that was very cool
and extremely touching. This is another book that I think it's hard to read without crying at like 3 or 4 points of the book. But it also is a very funny book. I don't want to sell it short for that. I've dwelt on some of its harsher aspects, but it is a pretty funny book and a crazy book. It's the kind of book that if you read to as a child, I read this book to my kid, and they desperately wanted me to read 2 or 3 chapters every night until we were done with this. So it passes that test, at least.
And that's exactly how I read it. I kind of just took it off the shelf and I was like, I'll read the first chapter. I'll read the second chapter. It was a pretty short chapter because the first chapter is like a page long. It's like, right. And it just kind of sucked me in. And I read it all very, very quickly, which was kind of rare at the time. And I know we're trying to talk about the lightness real quick, but can I talk about one more kind of darker detail that I really like?
Oh, please do. Yeah.
There's a point at which they're searching for the treasure by all kind of teaming up at the direction of the warden to dig one large hole.
Yep.
And at one point, Stanley, I guess, dumps some of his excavated dirt on top of dirt of another prisoner, Zigzag. And Zigzag, kind of without even saying what his grievance was, strikes Stanley over the head with a shovel and gives him like a pretty significant gash. And I liked that detail just because it's like, oh, yeah, I mean, you're starting to like all these guys, but they are troubled guys.
Yeah.
And then that added just that much, and that kind of gave this huge uncertainty to the rest of the book in terms of all of his interactions with pretty much everyone that wasn't Zero. Like, he was so unsafe in this place. And even if these people are pleasant enough, like, you don't necessarily know why any of them are there. So you can't necessarily be fully comfortable in any situation.
He doesn't try to make it into a clear case of these kids all don't deserve to be here. I mean, some of the kids very much are criminals. Whether or not they deserve to be stuck out in the middle of a desert with poisonous lizards everywhere is another story. Now, that's the other great reveal of the book, is that, there's two other weird coincidences that happen between past and present. It's the fact that Stanley heard the family tale of his grandfather surviving in the thumb of God that leads him to the mountain that he finds where that has fresh water in it and has the onions still growing, wild onions that Sam used to collect because it's the only place that can support life around there. And it's by eating all these onions and becoming permeated with onion smell and onion juice in their veins that when Zero and Stanley come back, they are trapped in a hole with the camp counselors eager to snatch them up. But they aren't going to enter the hole because in the hole with them are a family of yellow lizards, and whom they assume will just kill the two children if they wait long enough. But it turns out that onions actually do have tonic powers, and one of those powers is repelling lizards. So once again, it's hard to say what is good luck and bad luck in this story. Everything that seems bad turns out good. A lot of things that seem good, have a bad side to them as well. But that goes along again with the palindromic nature of everything in this.
Right. And so I'd like to talk a little bit about the movie for a second, if I can, and how it kind of treats a little bit of things differently. So the movie was written by the screenplay was by the author.
Right.
So it's very, very similar. But a key difference in the ending is all the boys are kind of at a party at Stanley's house, which in the book, it's just Stanley and Zero, which I thought was kind of, you know, it's where the movie kind of treats these kids at the camp as being kind of just normal kids who might have been there by bad circumstance or whatever. Whereas the book does, like we said a minute ago, leave them as criminals who are in a situation that they probably shouldn't be in. But there was another version of this movie that was commissioned by Disney before they made it, that was written by Richard Kelly, who went on to make Donnie Darko and a few other movies. And that is a very, very loose adaptation, and it is a dystopian story in which Stanley is accused of murder, which he did do. And they are not looking for treasure. They are looking for a weapon. Mr. Benny Dansky is a good guy.
Wait, what?
Yeah, no, I'll make this available. This screenplay is available online, and I'll make sure I post it on the Facebook page. That's why I wanted to talk. Yeah. So it's, and he's not Stanley Yelnats. The book opens with a nuclear bomb going off. the movie opens with a nuclear bomb going off, and you're in this dystopian Texas area, or, you know, Texas, you know, whether it's Dallas or Houston, it's not really clear or whatever. And yeah, it's a very, very bizarre take. And I think Disney got it. They said thank you and sent Richard Kelly on his way and hired the author to make a much more in line with the book adaptation. But that being said, I mean, dystopian stories became such a trend in the late 2000s. I wonder that if they were to adapt this again, or if they were adapting it for the first time now, if they would have gone for something more like that, or if they would have been more open to going with something like more like that.
I could almost understand that kind of cartoonish hyper, the world of, say, an early Tim Burton movie in which white America is parodied in its sort of in its banality and in its foibles. You could kind of use that to justify this harsh world that the kids find themselves in. You know, you could make not necessarily a dystopia that is a dystopia that was created by a nuclear war, but it could just be the dystopia of out of control white panic leading a world to, in which kids are being incarcerated and forced to work in labor camps. But oh my God, that is so weird. Now, you say this was before Donnie Darko?
Yeah, so this was Richard Kelly was working as a screenwriter, and he was commissioned this job, and his draft is dated December 17th, 1999. So it was pretty much not long after the book was released, about a year or so.
Wow, that is amazing. That's almost like a thing you would expect on a sketch show as a parody of someone writing a bad adaptation of a.
Well, it's very interesting. I mean, I read it back in high school. I haven't read it since. I'm probably going to. I didn't read it before this because I didn't want to get any wires crossed. but I recall thinking it was interesting and decent. The only thing that I remember not working was there's a narrator, and there's way too much narration that we don't need. But other than that, I can see it working as a movie, to be honest. But like I said, I'll post this on the Facebook page when this podcast releases.
I have not seen the 2003 movie in a very long time, but it is interesting. If you haven't seen it, it had a pretty fantastic cast, including a young Shia LaBeouf as Stanley, but it also had Sigourney Weaver as the warden and John Voight as Mr. Sir. So yeah, it's an interesting movie to go back and see if you haven't seen. Although I have a feeling that a lot of these listeners out here have seen the movie. This book, like The Westing Game, is a huge touchstone for young readers. It was not around when I was a kid, but if it were, I imagine it would be there up there with the books that I remember, The Phantom Tollbooth, being, oh yeah. Well, we can go back and do that, and then we can discuss the very, very strange Chuck Jones movie that was made of that.
Yeah, there's also a really terrible version of The Westing Game.
Oh yeah, that was made for TV.
Yeah, that's another one that's not very much like the book.
Didn't that have what's his name for as Sam Westing?
Ray Walston.
Yeah.
Oh no, he was Sandy McSouthers.
But as we remember, Sandy was one of Sam Westing's aliases. So.
Oh, okay. Well, there you go. I haven't read this book in a long
Walston.
Time. Great.
Yeah, yeah. I think we're starting to spin our wheels a little bit here, like poor Stanley did when he drove that truck into the hole, which we didn't cover. But I don't have anything to say much except that. Everyone who has not read this book, go out and read it. It truly is a magical book, and I am only sorry that it wasn't around when I was a kid. Do you have any last thoughts?
No, I think I disagree with you. It's just to sell the book a little bit more, it's a very quick read. I mean, if you're at all a fast reader, I think you can, or even a moderate reader, you can knock it out in a few hours.
Hey, I want to give you a chance to plug your book. You want to tell people about your book again?
Yeah, that'd be great. So I wrote a children's book that came out last February called The Bee with the Backward Stripes, which is about kind of bullying and acceptance, ultimately. It's available from pretty much all online retailers that I can think of. And if you'd like to support your local bookstore, if they don't have it in stock, pretty much any bookstore can order it for you.
Thanks to co-host Matt Skuda. You can find what he's up to at mattskuda.com. Sophomore Lit is brought to you by The Incomparable Network. Find more funny, smart podcasts online at theincomparable.com. You can write to me at sophomore.literature@gmail.com. You can join the Facebook group, or you can hit me up on the membership Slack. Next episode, we'll read A Prayer for Owen Meany. Keep up, sophomores. Remember, everything will be on the final.